Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco at the club's new offices at 110 The Embarcadero. And I'd like to welcome our radio and online audiences as well. So tonight we have John Judas here to speak about why has nationalism come roaring back. As you can tell by the full audience here, people have noticed that nationalism has come roaring back. John's book, The Nationalist Revival. He's also an editor-at-large for Talking Points Memo, and he's written 8 other books, and he's here to discuss a topic which is certainly getting our attention all around the world. Thank you very much for coming, John.
It's nice to be here. I used to live here during the 60s, and this is the first time I've ever been to the Commonwealth Club. I think probably next summer I'll be going to the Bohemian Grove, and then in the fall it'll be Davos, and I'll really be a big shot. I want to begin just by giving a sort of an unfavorable anecdote about myself. I was giving a talk to the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. I think that was the name of it. And it was for my previous book, The Populist Explosion. And I talked about NAFTA and how a lot of Trump supporters were animated by his opposition to NAFTA and in general by his criticisms of free trade. So after the talk, when you give a talk, usually after 45 minutes, you're exhausted and you don't want to talk to anybody, after it's all over. So somebody came up to me and said, why are you saying this about free trade? It's helping people around the world. And I said, I don't care about people around the world. I actually use the curse word, but I'm not going to include that. Another story. I was in Japan, and some very well-known intellectuals invited me over there, ran a think tank. The most sophisticated, moderate people you could imagine. And we were at a sushi bar. And I said, this place is wonderful, but I go to a place in the Florida Keys that's also terrific. And the guy said, well, it's probably run by Koreans. They're always stealing our ideas. I could tell more stories like this. We used to have a friend I won't even say what country, who used to come visit us. Left-wing guy, the biggest internationalist you could imagine. But you could get him to start running down these countries one by one. The French had a peculiar smell. The Swedes were dirty, et cetera, et cetera, in this most hilarious way. Now, why am I saying this? Because nationalism, nationality, the sense that we're Americans or we're French and somebody else is different from us is very much part of us. It's part of our nature. It's not biological. It's not the same thing as being part of a family, which you can't deny. I mean, it's just... But it's a stronger link, let's say, than being for a sports team. I've been a Raiders fan for, 30, 40 years, but the Las Vegas move has just done me in. I'm finished. It's harder to give up your American nationality in the same way or being French. And if you don't think about it, if you think, oh, that's, what he's saying is silly, think about 9/11 and your reaction when the Twin Towers were attacked. I mean, I felt I was sorry I was so old that I couldn't volunteer for the Army to go fight, really. Or if you go overseas, I've had this experience. I was in Germany for 3 months during the buildup to the Iraq War, and people were just running the country down, George W. Bush. And I shared all those criticisms, but yet I felt defensive and very defensive because it was my country. So there is this sense of nationality and nationalism, and it's part of our psychology, and we learn it as we grow up. And it's, in fact, it's very important and very positive in certain ways. First of all, you couldn't have a democracy without a common sense of nationality. Because what a democracy means is that you're willing to let somebody that you're never going to see, that you don't know, have an equal say in who's going to be the president of the United States or who's going to be your senator. Nationalism, nationality, it's also important to the welfare state. Think about this. You're paying taxes. Your taxes are going to go maybe to help somebody who's blind or handicapped in Reno, Nevada, that you're never going to see during your life. But you're willing to do that because that person is also an American. Now, when that breaks down, when you start to think, well, I'm not going to pay for that person because they're not really Americans, or I want to secede if you're a Catalan in Spain, then politics itself starts to break down and you start to have real problems. And that's, again, now we're getting closer to the kind of problems we're having in the world today. So, on this very basic sense, nationalism, nationality. In terms of the government, people do things because they're in the national interest. It's very hard to get something through and passed in Congress, you know, if you can give a good argument that it's not in the national interest. So it's implicit in our politics. It's something that Forbes, during one of the debates over Trump's policy, had a headline. It said, globalization is in the national interest. Now, you know, whether or not it is a question, but in order to justify it, they had to frame it that way. Now, let's move up one step from that. At certain times in history, you get an explicitly nationalist politics, an idea of us versus them, that it's us Americans versus somebody else, us French people, us Germans, what have you. Now, the common assumption, I think, going out of World War II, is that that's necessarily bad. Hitler, Mussolini. But if you think about it for a moment, it's appeared on the left, it's appeared in the center, it's appeared on the right. Abraham Lincoln was a nationalist, preserved the Union, right? Theodore Roosevelt was a nationalism. He called his politics the new nationalism. Charles de Gaulle, Winston Churchill. So left, center, but also Mussolini, also Hitler, and also Donald Trump. Now, one of the things that distinguishes our political era the last 20, 30 years is the rise of a right-wing rather than a centrist or a left-wing nationalism. And nationalist parties of this kind have become extremely powerful in Europe and the United States. France, the Front National, now it's called the National Rally. In Sweden, a country you wouldn't expect it, the Sweden Democrats now have a kind of deciding role in the what kind of coalition government's going to exist. Germany, the alternative for Deutschland. I could go on. Maybe 10, 15 countries in Europe have very powerful right-wing nationalist parties of this kind that are influential. And in the United States, we have Donald Trump. So the question I want to pose is why? Why in the last 20, 30 years have we had this rise of a kind of right-wing nationalism? Good. This is a time you can write down everything I... I need water. A few things. First, in the early 1990s, we had, in the wake of the end of the Cold War, and there was also a time of a big internet boom in the United States that begins in like 1995, 96. This burst of utopianism about what was possible globally. This is the era of globalization. And you get the idea then, and it really starts a little earlier, but it gets its big push then, that if we open up our markets globally, that if we allow corporations to move wherever they want, if we deregulate our financial institutions, if we don't any longer have a central currency that's dominating, that every other currency has to be evaluated in terms of, which we had before after World War II, and if we have free movement of people between countries, immigration, refugees, it will all, in the end, be for the best. And, you know, think about, again, about China during this period. You would be amazed if you don't remember that period or if you weren't following politics about the kinds of things that people expected when China would go into the World Trade Organization. And that was, again, part of this global utopia. It was going to become a liberal capitalist country. Really, within 10 years, 20 years, it would become more democratic, and it would have a capitalist system just like ours. Very similar expectations about Russia. So even finance, we were going to get out of the kind of boom-bust cycle that we've had been enduring. We were going to have a time where the recessions themselves would be banished. In the late 1990s, people in the Clinton administration thought, you know, there weren't even going to be any more things like recessions. And it was common even within the Federal Reserve, you would hear things like that. So there was this burst of utopianism. Europe, the euro, everybody's going to have a common currency. We're going to do away with borders. Well, what happened was that this great experiment that began in the early 1990s really didn't work out the way it was expected. And again, we'll go back to the woman who came up to me. Actually, there has been a rising standard of living across the world, you know, average, on an average. But within the United States and Western Europe and parts of Central Europe, you have this kind of very uneven development where partly as a result, let's talk again specifically about the United States, partly the result of automation, partly the result of competition from China. You know, the estimates is somewhere about, 2.5 million manufacturing jobs are lost from Chinese competition in the early 2000s. What you get in the United States and Western Europe is the creation of a kind of group that British sociologists have called the left behinds. They live in small, medium-sized towns, towns like Muncie, Indiana, Erie, Pennsylvania, naming towns where we had relatives. My wife is here, so she's familiar with these towns, that lose their manufacturing or they lose their mining. England, you get it in the northeast of England. France, you get it in northern France. The areas right below Calais, not Paris, but north of Paris. And these areas and the people within them become the main force behind the base of resentments which feed into this right-wing nationalism. They become the political base. But you have to add one more ingredient to it. Immigration. United States, well, you know, 1965, we changed our immigration laws. We had these very bigoted, restrictive laws before that, and we, 1965, we change, and we also have these family reunion, and we go from 4% people who are not native-born in the United States to about 13% now, big jump. In Europe, you get the single market where people can move wherever they want. Polish workers can move to Britain if they want. This is, again, this becomes the source of a lot of unease. You also get refugees from the wars in the Balkans in the 90s and then from the wars in the Middle East and then from the wars in North Africa as well as the famines. So you get this enormous flow of immigrants coming into these countries, into the United States, and into Western Europe and Central Europe. Wages are affected. You know, again, if you listen to the economists, they'll talk about, well, the average wage has actually gone up. So, but particular industries, and particularly some industries that used to be sort of middle class unionized, like meatpacking. You know, the reporters go into Iowa every 4 years for the primaries, and they wonder, oh my God, why are these people in northeast Iowa, or, no, it's northwest Iowa, so up in arms about immigration? Used to be primarily white, primarily a middle class unionized jobs in meatpacking in those cities, like what Storm Lake. You know who the congressman is there? Steve King. You know who he is, right? But these are all areas that were transformed from about 1980 to the early 2000s. The firms got rid of the unions. They got rid of the workers, mostly immigrants, a lot of illegal immigrants. Wages went down. It's now an extraordinarily unsafe, low-wage industry. The towns themselves were transformed. So you get economic resentment. You get the cultural resentment. Why are there all these signs in Spanish? Plus, you get the idea that, oh, why are we paying for the emergency rooms and taxes? So you get this combination. Same thing happens in England with the with Brexit, again, the northeast of England, France, Germany. You get this enormous influx of refugees. But you have to add another final ingredient because, you know, in the 1980s, 1990s, immigration was a big issue, especially in California. But it wasn't explosive. And particularly in Europe, it wasn't that explosive. The other ingredient is Islamic terrorism. You put those two together. You put together the idea, no matter how irrational it might seem, that, you know, the people who are coming over are not just going to, you know, maybe threaten jobs, threaten our existing way of life, but they're also going to blow up shopping malls. Right. This is the added ingredient. And, you know, again, if you think about Trump in 2016, what happened during that election? Two big San Bernardino and Orlando during that election, a big terrorist incident. Without those, again, you know, leave aside James Comey's letter, Trump might have been not have been president. And again, think about now what he's inventing with the 4,000 terrorists coming across the country. He's not inventing that, you know, because he's just an idiot, but he's trying to play on exactly that fusion of the fear of immigrants and the fear of Islamic terrorism. So you get those, and that's when you get the real burst of right-wing nationalism, particularly, again, even more than the United States and Europe. That's when, you know, all of a sudden in France, the Marie-Jean Le Pen, the father, who was kind of almost a neo-Nazi, comes in second in the election and knocks out the Socialist Party candidate in 2001, 2002. So really, that's the added ingredient. So you get the globalization, the threat to trade. You get people feeling that their jobs no longer exist. And combine that with immigration and Islam, and that's the basis for it. Now, what does that look like exactly in American politics? How does it manifest itself? Because, again, we're talking about a particular group of people. Maybe, again, in Trump, maybe 20% of the American electorate. What about everybody else? Well, I'm not going to cover everybody else, but I want to cover one specific kind of conflict that's going on, a cultural conflict in the United States. I've been talking about the left behinds. Now let's talk about another group. This is the group like me who live in, you know, big metro areas, or like you who live in San Francisco, high tech, finance, education, very advanced forms of biotech. Very fancy jobs, more high, again, higher income, more promise in terms of the future, but also multiple identities. I always like to tell a story about when we first moved to Washington in 1982, and I would go downtown and I would go to like a meeting at the New Republic for which I worked, and some big shot would be there. And I would always count to myself how long it was going to take for that person to tell me what university he went to. And if he went to Sonoma State, you would not hear about it. But Harvard, Yale, Princeton, and, you know, if he was really a big shot, you might even hear what prep school the guy went to. Again, we have multiple identities that we draw upon. We could live in a lot of different places. Guy in Britain, David Goodhart, calls this kind of people anywheres. That is, you know, I could be comfortable in Washington, D.C., San Francisco. My wife and I even thought of moving to Sydney for a little while. You know, Paris, London. We're people with multiple identities. You know, we work for firms that we're proud of. We make products that we're happy with. We're nationalists. We feel the same chords in our house. We celebrate Thanksgiving. But again, it's not central to us. Now look again at somebody who lives in a smaller, mid-sized town that's been decimated over the last 20 or 30 years. Somebody where that person, and I'll say he and his children, were able to look forward to lifetime employment. And it wouldn't necessarily be at GM. It could be at Sears. But again, where the prospects of life were very clear, where there was a neighborhood, where there was a neighborhood bar where everybody hung out, where there was a church where everybody went to. Now, again, what happens? A lot of those identities are stripped away in the last 30 or 40 years. The companies no longer exist. You know, it's not like we're not talking about the poorest people in the United States, but we're talking about somebody who doesn't necessarily work at Sears anymore, where they get benefits and everything like that in a unit, but they might work at the Amazon warehouse or something like that. Or they might work at Walmart, or they might work at a grocery store. Again, the whole complex of identity is shattered, and what happens? National identity becomes much more important and much more central. And the idea of some guy kneeling in the, you know, at a NFL game becomes just an enormous outrage, irrespective of what it was for, irrespective of what the cause was. It becomes, too, a part of a whole kind of complex, a way of life. You know, people talk, well, are these people worried about economics or culture? Well, it's a feeling, again, that a way of life is being destroyed. And, you know, what the whole idea of make America great again is restore a way of life that is being destroyed. So you have really a conflict between these two very, very different ways of life. And it's not like the people on one side are right or one side are wrong. I think there's an enormous gulf between them of misunderstanding. I mean, I read all these, political scientists. We'll look at the cosmopolitan side of it. You know, we're now having studies that prove genetically that certain people are conservatives or voted for Trump. I mean, really, it's just the... And you know, you again, I would always encounter the idea that every Trump voter is a racist, that these people are simply stupid and ignorant. You know, Hillary Clinton, after the election, she went to Mumbai, and let's see if I can find it. And she talked to, she characterized her voters as having been from, quote, the places that are optimistic, diverse, dynamic, moving forward, right? Exactly what I've been talking about, the cosmopolitan, the metro areas. And Trump's campaign and his followers as, quote, looking backward. You know, you didn't like black people getting rights. You don't like women. You don't, you know, getting jobs. unquote. So that on the one side. On the other side, a feeling that, again, people just don't get it. They don't understand what we're going through. I did a bunch of interviews in a little suburb of Ohio, of one of these decaying industrial towns. And afterwards, one of the people there, these were all Trump voters, sent me an email that somebody else had sent him, and it was after the Parkland massacre. You remember that with all the kids getting killed, and all of a sudden a big push for gun control. Now it seemed odd to me when I talked to these people and I asked them, "What does America First mean? What does it mean to make America great again?" Guns came up a lot. Now, why was that? As I remember, only one or two of them were actually hunters. It had nothing to do with that. Guns were, again, part of the home. They were making your home secure, your own safety. It was part of your basic identity. So he sent me this, friend sent me this email that a woman had sent him. And this was after Parkland, and she wrote, "I have really come to absolutely loathe liberals. The very same people who created the psychotic society we live in now are also the same ones screaming themselves blue in the face about taking everyone's guns away. The very same people who try and tell us that there's a gazillion different genders. The same people who destroyed the sanctity of life by avidly supporting the right to murder babies. The same people who have worked tirelessly attacking religion and telling everyone they can decide them for themselves what's right and what's wrong," and so on. So again, there's this tremendous gulf of misunderstanding in our politics. One way it oddly manifests itself, if you think about it, again, if you separate America into these big metro areas where a lot of the population is rising, and where you also get this idea that things that were once, you remember the expression about exurbs? Everybody thought exurbs, as opposed to suburbs, were going to be Republican. These are the, what would be an exurb around here? Mountain View or something like that. You know, so not right in the middle of the city and not a suburb. But you get these enormous growing metro areas on the one hand, and you get these small mid-sized towns in the Midwest and in the South. And one of the results of that politically is that in the Electoral College itself, think about this for a moment, or in Senate elections, where the size of population isn't crucial, where, you know, Montana gets to elect the same number of senators as New York State or California, the nationalist side of the equation is at a certain advantage. And again, we're talking broadly, I think, here about Republicans. Whereas in a congressional election, in the matter of who's going to win the popular vote, because you have these enormous metro areas, you're going to get the very likely Democrats, liberals, people's cosmopolitans. So the difference manifests itself politically in this kind of broken system we've had, where since, 2000, we had an election where one person won the popular vote and the other person won the election. We had the same thing in 2016. I think, again, that's characteristic of the kind of divided society we have. Now, in closing, let me just say something about, because somebody probably asked me this, about what I think this means in terms of what I would like to see happen and what I think how these conflicts can be resolved. Though I have to say that I don't really know how, but I'm just what the direction, what it would mean to take nationalism seriously, but for it to manifest itself not in the kind of toxic way it has in the last, 3 years in our country, 2 or 3 years. First, the idea that we need to have some kind of national planning in this country that would address the uneven development that faces us. where we have all these towns that are really decimated. What are we going to do about them? Are we just going to have a country where, we have some place like San Francisco where now people are going to have to pay $200,000 to, you know, for the right to buy a ticket to the Warriors games? Or are we going to have, a more equal society where industry, you know, is spread out, where there's more development in these parts of the country that have been neglected? So that's one really important thing that I think has to happen. And again, that's nationalism. That's, again, worrying about our nation. Economic security, especially now with the decline of unions, and especially among the young, there's a growing feeling, I believe, of growing anxiety about the future and about how we're going to make money and what kind of job we're going to have. I mean, I grew up at a time when, you know, jobs were just going begging. I mean, you really didn't worry about it. It's a much different time now. Now, the government's not going to be able to provide jobs for everybody. The private industry doesn't provide. But we have to provide the very basic things: health care, access to college education, protection of pensions, things like that. So, again, I sound like a Bernie voter. I was Medicare for all, things like that. So, but now I want to add a third thing. You can't have this. You can't have national planning. You can't have this kind of a welfare state or social democracy unless we have the feeling that we're one nation. And that means, again, addressing the problems about immigration in this country.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 500 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now, back to our program.
On the one hand, providing a path for citizenship for the people who are already here that are undocumented or unauthorized or whatever term you want to use, so they don't exist as an exploitable underclass. But on the other hand, border security and real regulations and an attempt, again, to move our immigration system in a way so that we get people that can more easily assimilate into the country and we don't have this feeling that we have all these separate multicultural, multi-nation, where we can restore the kind of feeling that we had, after World War II to a great extent, that we're one people. Because you can't have, and, you know, this is what happened with Obamacare. You know, it made perfect sense, but, you know, well, why am I going to pay for somebody else? You know, why do they deserve it? Some illegal immigrant's going to come into a clinic and they'll be able to get health insurance. So again, you have to have this sense of one nation and one people in order to have programs like that. But without programs like that, I think the country is going to be kind of a mess. The final thing is, when I talk about nationalism, I would contrast, again, what globalization with internationalism. Globalization in the sense of letting corporations do whatever they want in the world, move wherever they want. In other words, ceding national sovereignty to multinational corporations, or even to a greater state entity, international entity, is not something good. But what we do need is we need agreements among nations where nations do cede some of their sovereignty to deal with problems that you cannot deal with by one nation alone. And the obvious one is climate change, but also pandemics, nuclear proliferation, wars that break out with other countries, and, you know, even in the Middle East that could grow up into nuclear conflicts, or that could just, you know, blow up into in terms of refugees and destabilize all their neighbors. You have to have some kind of Again, international agreement. So I'm not trying to counterpose nationalism and internationalism. You have to have both. And the problem we've had in the United States and Western Europe is during this period of kind of utopianism of letting everything go, and that we could somehow do this, that we could have this kind of miraculous transformation and not worry about, let's say, borders, and not worry about all corporations all splitting for other countries. That was a mission of folly, and that's what we've been suffering with in the last 20 years.
So I'd like to remind our radio and online audiences that they're listening to John Judah speak about the nationalist revival. Why has it come roaring back?
Okay, so you can ask me whatever you want.
Hungary and Poland have been a lot in the news recently just about the rise of nationalism in Eastern Europe. And I was curious if you could talk about the causes and effects of nationalism in those countries and how you think that differs from what we're seeing in our country right now.
Ah, good. Yeah, I talk about that in my book. I spent a few weeks in those places. And I'm by far from an expert in them, but I'll tell you what I think. There's a fundamental difference between Western European countries that have had a long, long history of nationhood and democracy, and Poland and Hungary. Those are both countries that have suffered for a millennium from occupation, division, being carved up, where the sense of nationhood is much, much stronger even than it is in the Western European countries. Poland, where Catholicism and being Polish are fused together in a way that they really aren't in the rest of in the countries of Western Europe. What's happening now is that in some respects, you know, it's a kind of I hate to say bring Lenin into this, but he talked about one step forward, two steps backwards. It's more one and a half steps forward, one step backwards. They got free from the yoke of communism in late 1980s, early 1990s. Became part of Europe, but didn't fully accept all the strictures that the European Union laid upon them. So in some respects, what's happening in Hungary is they're going back to the Kádár regime of communist Hungary. When I was in the museum there, I was amazed that they had a niche for the Hungarian Revolution and then two rooms for Kádár, who was the head of Hungary during the last, 20 years. Poland, something somewhat similar is happening. So the transition to liberal democracy is going to take a bit longer there. And I think that's the main thing. And the in terms of the European Union, again, utopian, the idea that these countries would come in and immediately become like Belgium, you know, or what have you, you know. It isn't occurring. Instead, they're moving very slowly, and they haven't shed all of the authoritarian past from which they came.
I have a question of your... So, you say that there's definitely a situation where a democratic decision process does not require nationalism. There's also cases where sharing profit, sharing cost does not require nationalism. A situation where you share cost and share profit doesn't require nationalist, you know, elements. So it seems like a kind of a premature judgment saying that you have to have it. And you got plenty of East Asians, people from other areas immigrating to the United States, definitely not because we believe in the Christian or the Judeo-Christian idea of, or that America is somehow, we don't participate in that kind of nationalist discourse. So the question I have is, for what reason do we have to still redeem it? Definitely nationalism has delivered some really nice results. It doesn't mean we have to return to it. And the other question is, when you mention the left behind, when you're talking about it in terms of a mode of production, wouldn't the answer or the response be, well, further decimate those outmoded or less than competitive mode of production instead of kind of further nurturing them or allowing them further exist, creating more mobility for these people?
Okay, so oddly enough, I'm not arguing that we should return to nationalism. I'm arguing we already are. And that unless if you do not accept internally that you are an American and that other people who are American have a right to determine the future of the country, and I'm not trying to put you on the spot, I'm just using I'm using the you generically, then democracy doesn't work. In other words, if you think that, you know, a kind of odd, kind of political psychotic version of that is the belief that there's enormous election fraud. After the election, Trump said that he thought the, 2 to 5 million illegal immigrants had voted. But that's a symptom of not accepting that, again, we're one nation, everybody's an American, but suspecting that something's going on. So, again, what I'm arguing in the sense is that we have to give up a certain aberration and acknowledge that we are all Americans. Right?
I think the other element of the question was about people who've come from Asia, who have a different, don't come here for the culture, but come here for the American economic system.
That's been the secret of American economic growth for 200 years. So that's fine, and our immigration system has to be based upon that idea as well. So
there's a quote that's been floating around from attributed to Charles de Gaulle that says something to the effect that patriotism is the love of country and the love of your fellow countrymen, whereas nationalism is the hatred of your neighboring country and your neighboring people. And I suppose Trump plays that a little bit. Do you think there's any validity to that quote today?
I said this with when I was doing the talks on populism. There is no, definition of nationalism that fits all cases. What de Gaulle was talking about has a certain, has merit. But again, I would say that it's like many things. As Americans, we have certain kind of, because of our upbringing, certain suspicions of certain foreigners. It's a question of whether that determines our conduct. Let me use a very odd example. They have these psychologists, these same people who think everybody is voted for Trump is bad, have these implicit racism tests where you look at you look at images and then you press one or two on a computer and it figures out whether you're a racist. I was in 2016, I became convinced that Obama, in 2008, I became convinced that Obama couldn't possibly win the election. And so I was going to base it on on these racism tests. And I took the test, and it turned out I didn't score very well on it. Now, why do I say that? Because, people are complicated in that way. And while I blurted out to the woman, I don't care about people in the rest of the world, I do care about people in the rest of the world. So we're in terms of the de Gaulle quote, we can still dislike other people. We can still think the Irish are all drunks or whatever. But it doesn't necessarily determine our final decision, what we do. So that would be, again, my answer. The main thing is not to get away from the idea that there is this sense of national identity that we have, and to try to simply deny it or repress it and think that people who are patriotic or who worry about the national anthem have no basis at all for it. Why is it all in this side of the room? You must have stocked this side with... yeah, no, it's the right. Yeah, it's the, that's right. It's the French Assembly. It's the...
So I've read pretty extensively on this topic, would agree 100% with your assessment. My question is, why are so many smart metropolitan liberals, basically everybody in here, railing against, myself included, the symptom rather than the underlying disease? So Brexit is a symptom. Trump is a symptom. People seem to love making fun of Trump, but he's but a symptom. And maybe you can speak to the most recent symptom, which is the yellow vest protests in France.
I'm going to say why I think that I get it and other people might not. I grew up in Chicago. I was born same year as Bernie Sanders. And my parents were in manufacturing. And they lost their business in 1954 and we moved around. But for me and for many people of that generation, regardless of where we live now, when we went into a store in the 1950s and we looked for something to buy, let's say it was a camera, what have you, silverware, we looked to see if it was made in the USA. And we didn't do that because we were patriotic. It had nothing to do with that. We did it because we thought Americans made the best things. And, you know, the Japanese, it was all knockoffs. We wouldn't buy German things for other reasons. But you know, it was this incredible pride. And for people of my generation, again, and maybe particularly from the Midwest, from that area of the country, the late 70s, early 80s, when the car industry started to completely explode. You know, when you wanted a small car, you bought a Japanese car. When you wanted a TV, there were no American made anymore. RCA was now a Korean company. That was a tremendous shock. And I think, when Trump talked about Make America Great Again, people like me understood that immediately. Whereas, you know, a lot of Democrats and liberal Democrats and younger people who didn't have the same kind of experience just didn't get it. So I think it is, to some extent, a clash of experiences. You know, it's also a clash of generations. If you think about who lives in the small and medium-sized town, generationally, they're very much older. A lot of the young people leave town. They go to, Raleigh, Durham, or wherever. Ah, good. Somebody from the other side, finally. Not the far right.
You said something rather provocative but insightful to me, which is before we can understand why we should, let's say, vote or decide to vote for something like the Obamacare, we have to realize that we are voting for something that is for someone else, maybe some of us, that is we're doing it for other people.
Right.
In other words, we have to have a sense that we are a nation and right. that we're helping each other. Now, I think that before we start talking about nationalism and what it implies, you know, why is it that Kaczynski, for example, or the Oklahoma City bomber thought of a certain nation for themselves, you know, that they had an idea of the nation that was totally inimical to what the idea of the nation I have. So what is a nation? You know, should we define that before we decide that we all belong together?
Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, you know, life isn't political science, so... We can't, there isn't really no definition to begin with. I mean, it's not it's a term that appears in all kinds. You know, I was part of Raider Nation. What the hell is that? So it's not it's not like entropy, you know, or photosynthesis or something like that, where there's a specific definition, but there's citizenship, right? Mm-hmm. That's that's part of being a nation. You have certain requirements, and citizens can vote, and other people can't vote. And there's a process by which you become a citizen. And, you know, we have that, and it's worked for, you know, 250 years in the United States, but it's often we've had these times of immense turmoil. The 1880s to World War I, very similar in terms of immigration. I like to quote the Harry Truman. I wrote a book about Harry Truman in Israel before. And I promised that I would never talk about that subject again. But here's Harry Truman in 1919 visits New York City, okay? And he says, he writes his cousin, this town has 8 million people. 7,500,000 of them are of Israelish extraction. 400,000 WAPs, and the rest are white people. Now, again, you know, what's peculiar about that? Jews and Italians weren't white people then. Yeah. And that's, again, it's not a matter of definition. It's we have a kind of unconscious and sometimes conscious vision of what is an American. So beyond the citizen being a citizen and having these legal requirements, there's a psychology. And the psychology develops, and we're in a time of turmoil where there are a lot of people who don't accept. African Americans are the classic problem in terms of accepting, because whiteness has become is really the mark of being an American still, unconsciously for many people. Asian Americans. Hispanics, I think within 20, 30 years, there won't be any distinction. Intermarriage, stuff like that, it's going to happen. But again, I think the black-white division is going to remain. So I'm talking sort of around your question, but I'm saying that being a nation has these kind of formal requirements, citizenship and things like that. But then there's a kind of deeper psychology. There's an image we have and that people have of what it is to be an American. And right now, a lot of our problems are that there are groups of people who think that some other people are not really Americans and don't belong here.
So one of the solutions you put out there was around trying to address some of the economic disparity, particularly in either industrial areas or rural areas. Just considering, as we're talking about far-right nationalism, how strongly correlated that is with at least the rhetoric of Tea Party or things like small government, unrestrained capitalism, self-reliance, that kind of thing. If I'm to infer that sort of, addressing the economic disparity would involve government intervention or policy, it seems like oil and water to me. So, A, do you think it's truly viable that the far-right nationalists would allow for more government intervention to address that? And B, if so, then is it marketing or is it a fundamental shift in how people see the role of government?
Well, you know, that's a... It's a $64,000 question. It's let me just, because this is one of the last questions anyway, so let me just do both things. Both international, you could have asked the same skepticism about international agreements that you asked about nationally. In the past, in the United States, we have only had agreement about major national intervention in the economy during depressions and wars, or massive political movements like the civil rights movement of the 50s and early 60s. So it's going to take a lot of turmoil. It's not something that'll just happen. And that's, again, why I feel a little queasy about making my proposals, because you're absolutely right. There's enormous resistance to it. We don't have a kind of status governmental past that, let's say, France has, Germany, Switzerland, whatever, where people just accept government intervention. Our default position is that, there's something wrong. So it usually takes something something to jolt us to make that possible. The second thing that I'm just putting another question in it is, how will we get to the point of dealing with, let's say, climate change internationally. When Kyoto was signed by the Clinton administration, they brought it to the Senate, and I think it was 99-0 or something against it, a resolution. It was not even close. Enormous resistance, economic resistance. How are all these countries going to come to some kind of an agreement? Now, in the past, what's happened, the major international institutions that we've had in the past, if you think of the International Monetary Fund, the United Nations, even the European Union, they all grew out of wars, big wars. But we can't afford to have another war, a world war. It's we're in a nuclear era. So we're in, again, a question of what's going to jolt us. I mean, will it take a tsunami that sweeps away half of Italy? What is it going to take for us to get from where we are to there? And I do not have that answer. And that's the dilemma that we face now.
This is probably a gross oversimplification of the very complicated situation that we're in. But my question is, would you agree that a key driver of the rise of nationalism in the United States is very much linked to the growing gap between the very wealthy and the very poor? And if so, would it be just too naive to think that a national strategy to reverse that trend or putting in place policies that simply are aimed towards leveling out that gap?
I do not think that the gap between the very wealthy and the very poor is a major driver of American politics. If anything, we have one party, the Democrats, that unites now a lot of the very wealthy and the very poor. The problem's more in the middle. It's more the 70% below and the sort of, I mean, if you want to use quintiles, is that okay if we do quintiles? The second and third quintile, not the poorest people. And especially the people who could in the past look forward to their kids moving up, to lifetime employment and things like that, who are not poor now by any means. That's where the real political dilemma is. And we have, it used to be between the Democrats and the Republicans, it looked like a pyramid for the most part. You know, all the rich people were Republicans and the poor people are Democrats. Now it's almost the Democratic Party's like, is becoming like an hourglass. Now a lot of the very richest people might be, Republicans, but the upper middle class, the professionals, and then if you want to do a parody of it, the nannies they hire, the people who, work at the fast foods, they're all, so it's the poorest, the minorities, plus the upper middle class, and the Republicans, the Trump voters, are all sort of in the combination of the upper and the middle. But it's screwed up that way. It's not rich versus poor. So it's not 99% versus the 1% in America. That's not really the problem. I'm not approving of all these. I mean, I think that one of the things we have to do is change our tax structure. Because we're not going to have full employment, I don't believe. I think we're always going to have some kinds of problems with employment, but we have to have sufficient tax base so we can provide economic security for people. And if we keep cutting corporate taxes and taxes on the wealthy, we don't have that. So that's the area that I would, but I'm not saying that that's yet a huge issue for people.
It's time for just a couple more questions. I think we'll have to stick to the center.
Yes, could you talk about some instances of left-wing nationalism?
Well, you want to talk about Lincoln? Abraham Lincoln uniting the Union against secession would be the classic example. Theodore Roosevelt more center-left, but again, the idea that there was this enormous class struggle going on and you had to somehow transcend it, and you also had to heal the wounds of the North and South that had been created by the Civil War, and that was the heart of the new nationalism. Franklin Roosevelt, again, a lot of nationalist appeals, especially in his 1936 and his big campaign there against the economic royalists. So we've had this, if you want to go to Fred Harris, and again, Bernie Sanders had elements of that, all the Democrats. It's just that often they get stuck on certain issues, like presently immigration, where they get the two parties seem to be talking from different ends.
Has anybody given the thought that everything is perfect just the way it is and get over yourself?
There are these people.
Americans have too much time, freedom, and money, and they talk too much, and they let the media run their lives because they've lost the capacity, a lot of Americans, to think on their own two feet. And they just regurgitate what the media gives them. What if it's all just perfect and get over yourself?
Uh-huh. That would be a simple answer.
I'll close with an anecdote, and this doesn't necessarily have nothing to do with nationalism. My wife and I have a dear friend who was a journalist who lost his job for various reasons, and then went through this terrible libel lawsuit where he was accused unfairly of being a communist, and he lived in a little house in outside of Copenhagen, and he had three wonderful daughters. And when he couldn't find work, his wife, who was a defense consultant, she had a big job as an executive. So she supported the family, and they did all right. And in about 2012, she got lung cancer, terminal lung cancer. She had to quit working. 2 years later, she died, and at the same time, my friend won his lawsuit. But in the meantime, what happened? She got free care. The three kids, two of them went to college for free. Their one's now an engineer, the other's a journalist. The other went to high school. They kept their house. United States, they would be ruined. So nothing, no self-reliance can help in this kind of situation. So again, my feeling and this feeling of what we want to do as Americans is to have that kind of basic economic security so that kind of thing doesn't happen. And if you go to Europe, that is something that they have created since World War II, and it's better.
Yeah, I always thought that Gorbachev should have gone to the UN and said, well, yes, we were extremists, but as a result, the Western Europeans and you all have a social safety net to make sure that your countries didn't go down to communism, and that works better for democracy overall. So, but he never did take that speech idea and run with it. So thank you very, very much, John, sure. for coming and talking to us. And your book is available, The Nationalist Revival. And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 116th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much.